Chapter 2 of John Brown by W. E. Burghardt Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Making of the Man. There was a man called of God, and his name was John. A tall, big boy of 12 or 15, barefoot and bareheaded, with buckskin breeches suspended often with one leather strap over his shoulder, roamed in the forests of northern Ohio. He remembered the days of his coming to the strange wild land. The lowing oxen, the great white wagon that wandered from Connecticut to Pennsylvania and over the swelling hills and mountains, where the wide-eyed urchin of 5 sat staring at the new world of wild beast and the wilder brown men. Then came life itself, in its realness, the driving of cows and the killing of rattlesnakes, and swift free rides on great mornings alone with earth and tree and sky. He became a rambler in the wild new country, finding birds and squirrels and sometimes a wild turkey's nest. At first, the Indians filled him with strange fear, but his kindly old father thought of Indians as neither vermin nor property, and this fear soon wore off, and he used to hang about them quite as much as was consistent with good manners. The tragedy and comedy of this broad, silent life turned on things strangely simple and primitive: the stealing of 3 large brass pins, the disappearance of the wonderful yellow marble which an Indian boy had given him, the love and losing of a little bob-tailed squirrel for which he wept and hunted the world in vain, and finally the shadow of death which is ever here, the death of a ewe lamb and the death of the boy's own mother. All these things happened before he was 8, and they were his main education. He could dress leather and make whiplashes, he could herd cattle and talk Indian, but of books and formal schooling he had little. John was never quarrelsome, but was excessively fond of the hardest and roughest kind of plays, and could never get enough of them. Indeed, when for a short time he was sometimes sent to school, the opportunity it afforded to wrestle and snowball and run and jump and knock off old seedy wool hats offered to him almost the only compensation for the confinements and restraints of school. With such a feeling, and but little chance of going to school at all, he did not become much of a scholar. He would always choose to stay at home and work hard rather than be sent to school. Consequently, he learned nothing of grammar, nor did he get at school so much knowledge of common arithmetic as the 4 ground rules. Almost his only reading at the age of 10 was a little history to which the open bookcase of an old friend tempted him. He knew nothing of games or sports. He had few or no companions, but to be sent off through the wilderness alone to very considerable distances was particularly his delight. By the time he was 12 years old, he was sent off more than 100 miles with companies of cattle. So his soul grew apart and alone, and yet untrammeled and unconfined, knowing all the depths of secret self-abasement and the heights of confident self-will. With others, he was painfully diffident and bashful, and little sins that smaller souls would laugh at and forget loomed large and awful to his heart-wrenching vision. John had a very bad foolish habit, I mean telling lies, generally to screen himself from blame or from punishment, because he could not well endure to be reproached, and I now think, had he been oftener encouraged to be entirely frank, he would not have been so often guilty of this fault, nor have been, in after life, obliged to struggle so long with so mean a habit. Such a nature was in its very essence religious, even mystical, but never superstitious nor blindly trustful in half-known creeds and formulas. His family was not rigidly Puritan in its thought and discipline, but had rather fallen into the mild heathenism of the hard-working frontier until just before John's birth. Then, his father relates in quaint Calvinistic patois, "I lived at home in 1782. This was a memorable year, as there was a great revival of religion in the town of Canton. My mother and my older sisters and brother John dated their hopes of salvation from that summer's revival under the ministry of the Reverend Edward Mills. I cannot say as I was a subject of the work, but this I can say, that I then began to hear preaching. I can now recollect most, if not all, of those I heard preach, and what their texts were. The change in our family was great. Family worship set up by Brother John was ever afterward continued. There was a revival of singing in Canton, and our family became singers. Conference meetings were kept up constantly, and singing meetings, all of which brought our family into a very good association, a very great aid of restraining grace. Thus, this young freeman of the woods was born into a religious atmosphere, not that of stern intellectual Puritanism, but of a milder and more sensitive type. Even this, however, the naturally skeptical bent of his mind did not receive unquestioningly. The doctrines of his day and church did not wholly satisfy him, and he became only to some extent a convert to Christianity. One answer to his questionings did come, however, bearing its own wonderful credentials, and credentials all the more wonderful to the man of few books and narrow knowledge of the world of thought, the English Bible. He grew to be a firm believer in the divine authenticity of the Bible. With this book he became very familiar. He read and reread it. He committed long passages to memory. He copied the simple vigor of its English, and wove into the very essence of his being its history, poetry, philosophy, and truth. To him, the cruel grandeur of the Old Testament was as true as the love and sacrifice of the New, and both mingled to mold his soul. This will give you some general idea of the first 15 years of his life, during which time he became very strong and large of his age, and ambitious to perform the full labor of a man at almost any kind of hard work. Young John Brown's first broad contact with life and affairs came with the War of 1812, during which Hull's disastrous campaign brought the scene of fighting near his western home. His father, a simple, wandering old soul, thrifty without foresight, became a beef contractor, and the boy drove his herds of cattle and hung about the camp. He met men of position, was praised for his prowess, and let listen to talk that seemed far beyond his years. Yet he was not deceived. The war he felt was real war, and not the war of fame and fairy tale. He saw shameful defeat, heard treason broached, and knew of cheating and chicanery. Disease and death left its slimy trail as it crept homeward through the town of Hudson from Detroit. The effect of what he saw during the war went so far to disgust him with military affairs that he would neither train nor drill. But in all these early years of the making of this man, one incident stands out as foretaste and prophecy, an incident of which we know only the indefinite outline, and yet one which unconsciously foretold to the boy the life deed of the man. It was during the war that a certain landlord welcomed John to his home, whither the boy had ridden with cattle 100 miles through the wilderness. He praised the big, grave, and bashful lad to his guests, and made much of him. John, however, discovered something far more interesting than praise and good food in the landlord's parlor, and that was another boy in the landlord's yard. Fellow souls were scarce with this backwoodsman, and his diffidence warmed to the kindly welcome of the stranger, especially because he was black, half-naked, and wretched. In John's very ears, the kind voices of the master and his folk turned to harsh abuse with this black boy. At night, the slave lay in the bitter cold, and once they beat the wretched thing before John's very eyes with an iron shovel, and again struck him with any weapon that chanced. In wide-eyed silence, John looked on and questioned, was the boy bad or stupid? No, he was active, intelligent, and with the great warm sympathy of his race did the stranger numerous little acts of kindness, so that John readily, in his straightforward candor, acknowledged him fully, if not more than, his equal. That the black worked, and worked hard and steadily, was in John's eyes no hardship, rather a pleasure. Was not the world work? But that this boy was fatherless and motherless, and that all slaves must of necessity be fatherless and motherless, with none to protect them or provide for them, save at the will or caprice of the master, this was to the half-grown man a thing of fearful portent. And he asked, Is God their father? And what he asked, 1.5 million black bondmen were asking through the land. End of chapter 2.